well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And yet, it is. And that's what we're talking about on today's Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Thanks so much for being a part of the program. I, of course, am Cam Edwards. We're going to be talking with New York Second Amendment attorney Amy Bellantoni here in just a minute. We've got several cases to talk about. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We've got a case with a good decision. We've got a couple of ongoing cases, two of which are actually both infuriating, just in different ways. In one case, this is the state of New York actively trying to disarm or prevent as many people as possible from exercising their Second Amendment rights, even if that contradicts state statute, much less federal court decisions. Then you've got another case where the city of New York is offering up a very novel theory to try to keep a statute that has already been declared unconstitutional, not only on the books, but continue to enforce this. And so far, the Second Circuit, with a wink and a nod, has allowed New York City to proceed with this novel legal theory. It is a fascinating conversation. I will tell you, it's probably going to get your blood boiling, too. So be prepared. If you need to take your blood pressure medicine before we get started, go ahead, hit the pause button, and take a listen to this conversation between myself and Amy Bellantoni. Amy, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you bet. You have been very busy in the new year. We have a lot of cases to talk about, including, let's start with some good news, because, you know, it's always good to talk about a victory. And there was a really great decision and a very readable opinion in a case that that you are the plaintiff's attorney for. This is the Sedita case. Is that right? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Sedita. Yes.
Sedita case. And I wrote about this at Bearing Arms, but for folks who didn't see this story, this is a case, I guess it depends on, right, if you're talking to the plaintiff or the defendant, whether this is a case about a denial of somebody's ability to buy a firearm or just a delay that lasts for years and years, but not an outright denial, right? Because that's what the government contends is going on.
Right. So in the Sedita case, my client had, every time he went to purchase a firearm, ultimately we found out through the motion that was filed by the government that it was a denial, that it was a delay. It was not, in their opinion, a denial. And so we sued under the federal statute, 925A, that allows for suits to be brought to require NICS to correct its records. And we also sued under a Second Amendment violation. Ultimately, the court found that we weren't able to go forward with the statutory cause of action because it was, in fact, not a denial. It was a delay. Although we did argue in the papers that at the point in time that the statute was enacted, there was no such thing as a delay. The delay process didn't come about until years later. So we argued that, you know, look, if you're delayed, you're denied. If you can't leave the store after a background check for a person who has no disqualifiers, then essentially that's a denial. But nevertheless, we weren't able to proceed, going forward on the statutory claim.
But on the Second Amendment claim, you were able to proceed, right?
Yes, yes. So the court did allow us to go forward on the Second Amendment claim. And there was really, this decision was so just really well put together. And smart and just so positive. And of course, as you know, coming from New York State, when you get a positive decision that's got common sense and it's rationally based, it's just such a breath of fresh air, which this was.
Absolutely. Now, I don't have the opinion right in front of me, so I'm going off of memory. So correct me if I get anything wrong here. But your client, as you say, repeatedly reached out to NICS and said, hey, you need to correct this, right? And kept getting the runaround. And this didn't go on for weeks or months. This went on for years. And sometimes your client would hear back. Sometimes your client would not hear back at all from the government, right? And the judge in this case described what your client was going through as Kafka-esque, Right. So there's this process in place by which you can appeal and which you can tell Knicks to get their act together and fix these records. And that's what your client was doing. And it's not that the government was entirely unresponsive, because sometimes he would get a reply, but they were inactive. They weren't taking the actions that they were supposed to take to fix this problem.
Correct. Yeah. So the burden is on Knicks, right, to make sure that if they're going to delay or deny someone, there has to be some kind of actual record that shows that they're a prohibited person. So for denial, you know, that the person has a prohibitor, like a felony conviction, or they're under an active order protection. For a delay, there are 3 business days in which the Knicks people can investigate to see, in other words, reach out to the court, reach out to law enforcement, follow up with what they think may be a prohibitor to ascertain whether the person is actually prohibited or not prohibited. So in theory, yes, the delay process is helpful, because if someone, you know, if the Knicks office needs to look into whether an assault conviction actually is related to an underlying domestic violence crime, or, you know, there's a domestic relationship there. Apologies, domestic relationship there, that there is a prohibitor. And if they can't find that out within that 3-day period, then it, you know, the gun store can proceed. In New York State, there's an additional 30 days tacked on. So in New York State, you have more than the 3-day waiting period. And sometimes the gun stores won't even allow the transaction to take place at that point in time. So in 2021, my client had been, I'll just say delayed, because that's the point that we're at now, had been delayed twice, and wasn't able to proceed with the transactions that he intended to make. And so, yes, we wrote to the Knicks office just to find out what the prohibitor was, because normally I'll have my clients go and get their fingerprints taken so I can get their criminal history report, take a look and say, yeah, you have a prohibitor here. Let's just get that resolved. You know, let's get a certificate of relief. Or the court got it wrong. You know, we need to correct the records in whatever court, you know, is sending improper information to the state, which is in turn reporting to Knicks. But that wasn't the case here. The case here was Knicks was delaying my client, which ultimately, I think it was a year after trying to correspond with Knicks, they finally gave us the reason for the delay, which was you have a prohibitor that either was you're under an active order protection, or you have a conviction for a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, which he had neither of. So,
okay. So after this decision came down and you and your client were successful here, has the situation been rectified? Is he no longer getting these delays when he tries to buy a firearm?
Well, he has not, to my knowledge. I'm not sure whether he's actually tried to purchase again. I mean, there were 3 times throughout the course of this situation. I don't know. I haven't gotten any information from the government that they've corrected, you know, their files. But I don't believe that he's tried to, again, purchase anything, you know, to see whether he's going to continue to be delayed.
Okay.
So ultimately the burden is on Knicks, but we ended up having to go to the courts to do Knicks's job for them, to put a packet together that said, you know, this is the complaint. These are the police reports. He had an attempted assault in the 3rd degree, which is a misdemeanor, with a male complainant that had nothing to do with the domestic violence or domestic relationship. And we sent that packet down to them. And that still didn't suffice for Knicks. They continued to keep him as a potentially prohibited person. And this is not the only case. I have another individual who has a similar, you know, assault conviction in California, and we're probably going to be filing a lawsuit within the next couple of weeks on that as well.
Okay. It's going to be interesting to see how the Trump administration responds to these things, too, right? Because you've got Attorney General Pam Bondi, who's been tasked with taking a look at not only the ATF rules and regulations that came down under the Biden administration, but all the federal gun statutes and what DOJ has been defending over the past 4 years. So I'm curious to see if that will offer you and your clients some relief as well. All right. So that's the good news. Now let's talk about some bad news. Let's talk about what's going on in New York State. And again, we're talking about, right, a disqualifying factor that shouldn't be a disqualifying factor, it sounds like, Amy.
Correct. So an attempted assault third is not a disqualifier, or an assault third misdemeanor is not a disqualifier unless it involves an underlying domestic relationship, family members, or you have a child in common. I think it's even broader than that, too, if you're in some kind of relationship, like boyfriend, girlfriend.
Right, like a dating partner, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but it's their obligation to find out. But, and it's funny that you mentioned the changeover in the administration, because I've been doing this for a couple of decades now. And I have noticed a trend that when, the Democrats are in office, NICS gets a little wonky. And when they're not, then they're doing their job. So I can only speculate that there may be something tied in there with the administration. So hopefully things go more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So what's going on with this? Because before we started recording here, you were telling me about another case that you're working on. This one out of Buffalo, New York, right? And this one dealing with state law.
Yeah. So one of the prohibitors under federal law is if an individual has either been adjudicated as mentally defective or if they've been, quote, committed to a mental institution. Now, at least seven circuits have held that committed to a mental institution does not include individuals who are briefly in a hospital or admitted to a hospital for observation or emergency observation or temporary evaluation, even if it involves care and treatment. And in fact, the federal statute and the CFR, I can't remember the exact number of the CFR, but the codes specifically talk to that being an exemption. If someone is admitted voluntarily or if they're admitted just for observation and evaluation, then that is not a disqualifying event, only if someone has been committed. Well, under New York state law, mental hygiene law 9.39 is entitled roughly, emergency evaluation, emergency admissions for evaluation, care, and treatment. Now, historically, New York State has interpreted 9.39 to be an involuntary admission, involuntary commitment. The words admission and commitment, they're used interchangeably, but all of the case law has talked about the 9.39 admission as being involuntary in the context of due process. So is the individual entitled to a hearing for that admission and so forth? The statute itself speaks to an allegation. So if someone's admitted under 9.39, it's an allegation that they have a mental illness and an allegation they're alleged to be dangerous to themselves or others. And there's a particular portion of the statute that talks to even if a court issues an order holding someone under 9.39, that shall not be considered an adjudication of mental illness. So 9.39, without question, is not a finding that someone is mentally ill. Okay, this is just a safe period of time for someone going through something, an acute emergency or medication reaction or something, to be put into a hospital, even if it's involuntary, and assessed and for things to get worked out. Now, if that person is deemed to be a danger and is deemed to be mentally ill, then they're converted to, the commitment statutes. But if not, they must be discharged. So I've had several clients, I've had numerous clients over the years, several of which are pending in various courts and federal courts throughout the state, who have undergone, 9.39 admission, temporary. One guy, a veteran, 11 hours that he was in the hospital and discharged, and still New York State is reporting him to NICS as having been committed to a mental institution. So there's a lot of overreporting. So the Buffalo case that you mentioned, my client is Department of State in the Diplomatic Security Office. He's a federal law enforcement officer who had a temporary stay in a hospital in 2015. And he didn't know, because there's also a due process issue with New York State doesn't tell you when you've been disarmed. Now you're a prohibited person. If you hold a firearm or try to buy a firearm, you're committing a felony. but they don't let you know that. And he went to buy purchase a firearm in November of last year and was denied. And when he followed up to see why his transaction was denied, he found out that New York State's been reporting him to NICS for the past, 15 years. Meanwhile, he's been an armed law enforcement officer that entire period of time. And nobody, and didn't know it. So.
Wow. That is, that is so abusive, Amy. And we talk a lot about, mental health and gun ownership on this program. I am a big believer in supporting mental health for gun owners. I think it's something that needs to be less taboo. But you look at things like what New York's doing here. You want to make it more difficult. You want to make it harder for people to reach out and get help. You want to make it, you want to put people's backs up so that they don't seek help when they need it. Keep doing stuff like this. This is so contrary to supposedly the stated goals of the mental health hygiene law in New York State, right? Because you are scaring people away from seeking treatment if they know that 11 hours under observation results in a lifetime deprivation of their right to keep and bear arms. This, I've heard a lot, I've been covering this issue for 20 years. There's not a lot that actually makes me really pissed off when I hear about this. This pisses me off, Amy. So where is this case right now? What's the status?
We filed a motion for a preliminary injunction because it was so recent that the denial happens.
Okay.
And the state proffered analogs for, under step two of the Bruin test to try and argue that this was historically, feasible and accurate, which it is not. The judge, and so let me just say, the preliminary injunction that we filed, I didn't seek to enjoin the entire, 9.39 reporting for the whole state because okay. I knew that would be a big ask, right? So it was very narrow. It was, listen, just enjoin NICS, enjoin New York State from reporting my client to NICS. Take it.
This was just an as-applied challenge then,
right? As-applied. I mean, the complaint itself does seek to, it's facially unconstitutional, but it's okay. Also as-applied. The PI was very narrow. And during the oral argument, the judge even said, well, yeah, your guy's not in danger. There's no problem with him, but still the denial of the PI came out and it's just, I'm really not, it blows my mind. It really just blows my mind that even as applied to my client, who is conceitedly, obviously not a danger to anyone, not a danger to himself, never been found to be, have a mental illness, has been carrying a firearm and protecting our, our country and diplomats and is now, continued to be found to be a prohibited person and mentally unfit. And, and not only is it affecting his Second Amendment rights, but it's also affecting all of the criminal cases that he's been, has the potential of affecting all the criminal cases that he's been involved in since 2015, because the state has been saying that he is mentally unfit for the past 15 years. So, what is that, what impact is that going to have on all the cases that he's been involved in over those years?
Yeah. Okay. It is egregious. And please keep us up to date on what's going on with this case and the others that, are taking on the same issue here, because again, this is a major, major problem. I'm really glad that you're bringing this to light. All right. So the last thing I want to talk about, the Supreme Court goes back in conference this Friday. They've got a number of 2A cases that are coming down the road. You've got responses that are due, I think, in 3 or 4 2A cases later this month or at least in March. They've held on to the Snope assault ban case out of Maryland. I think that's been relisted 6 times. Ocean State Tactical, which is the magazine ban out of Rhode Island, that's been listed 7 times. We don't know what's going on with the court and why they're keeping a hold of these cases, but you have a case that you are hoping that the Supreme Court will take up later this year, right?
Yes. So we had a win in New York City, which was just phenomenal, in the Soror versus New York City case. It was a challenge to the moral character requirement that New York City has for individuals seeking just to possess rifles and shotguns. It's a discretionary and very subjective licensing regime there. And when the case went up to the Second Circuit, the city issued my client his licenses and then argued that their appeal, because they're the ones who had appealed the district court loss, their loss, They argued that their appeal was moot and asked the court to dismiss their appeal and then to vacate the district court's permanent injunction of the unconstitutional statute. So the Second Circuit did just that. They, of course, got rid of the case. And so we filed a petition for certiorari seeking to have the court reverse the Second Circuit. And the issue here is this. When a statute has been found by the district court to be facially unconstitutional, which is rare that is a successful challenge.
Right. That means that in no circumstance is that law constitutional, right? No circumstance. Right. Okay.
Right. So the New York City statute was found facially unconstitutional. And yet the government was able to, by its own voluntary action, because licensing is discretionary in New York State, fully discretionary, there's no shall issue anything, by issuing the plaintiff a license, argued that their appeal was moot, and then essentially won their appeal by collaterally attacking, the decision itself. So the question is, when a statute is found facially unconstitutional, can it ever be mooted out? Can it be mooted out by the government? Can it be mooted out by the plaintiff? Because at that point in time, it really, the issue doesn't belong to the plaintiff. It belongs to the people and the public, and the stakes are just too high. And so I'm asking the Supreme Court to take that question up, and hopefully they will. I believe the city's response is due sometime in March.
Okay.
That's a serious question.
It is a serious question because, I mean, if you think about this, if New York City can keep this a statute that's been ruled facially unconstitutional, never can this be a constitutionally applied statute. But yet they can keep it on the books. They can continue to enforce it because they gave a person the license that they requested.
Right.
How do you ever get that bad law off the books? Right. Because every time it's challenged, the city can just say, OK, fine, you get your license. This goes away. And then they deny 15 other people before somebody hires an attorney and takes them back to court. And then they just rinse and repeat that same cycle again. Right.
Yes, that is New York City's M.O. I've had several cases now where they've gone up to the Second Circuit or were in the district court and they issued the license. One guy, they mailed it to his house and he had moved. And obviously they didn't care how dangerous he was when they denied him the license. They just threw it in the mail, at which he never received. But then they argued in the district court that, we gave him the license and now it's moot. So you have to get rid of the case. And they've continuously been evading the review of their statutes. And it also leaves the district court in the Soror case with kind of an anomaly because now you have a decision that's only been vacated in part by the Second Circuit. You have a decision that says you violated the Second Amendment rights of Mr. Soror, yet where are the teeth? It means nothing because now you're just going to keep violating his rights. And he's still under the same licensing scheme. So when he has to reapply, because the rifle shotgun licenses expire after 3 years. So when he has to reapply, he's going to be subject to the same discretionary, you had a poor driving history. Oh, well, you jaywalk. Well, jaywalking, I guess, is legal now. But, every trivial violation of the law now sets up an opportunity for them to deny him and everybody else. So.
Well, I know that the good moral character requirement is a part of the Antonyuk challenge to the Concealed Carry Improvement Act. So I'm glad to see that subjective determination that, New York is still doing after Bruin is being challenged on multiple levels. Right. So you've got your case going after New York City's discretionary issuing of premise permits. Right. And then you've also got to Antonyuk going after the carry permits. I got to tell you, Amy, I don't know how you do it every day without just blowing your top. But I admire your patience and your perseverance in defense of our Second Amendment rights because, you are fighting behind enemy lines there in New York State.
Yeah, 100%. God's will, man. That's all I can say. I just keep looking up and he just keeps giving me the strength to go forward. So,
meditate, do yoga, take your retreats, whatever you got to do to stay in the fight because we need you out there. And Amy, again, thank you so much for coming on the program. It is always a pleasure speaking to you, even when what you're talking about is infuriating. And I do hope we get a chance to do this again very soon.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Amy Bellantoni joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. My thanks to Amy for joining us on the program. And again, I am just incensed about those stories and cases out of a New York State. Absolutely. I can't say it's unbelievable at this point because it's entirely believable, given what we've seen from New York, but it is appalling, despicable, disgusting, whatever other word you want to use. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Let's see, we will start with our recidivist report, which, as was the case yesterday, comes from Minnesota. You know, it used to be that if I needed to find a recidivist report, I could generally look at what was going on in Cook County, Illinois. I tell you, I didn't specifically look for a story out of Minnesota today. I just happened to run across it. But here you go. In fact, I think this was the same media outlet as a yesterday's story, which, of course, was the it was 19 years old who accidentally fatally shot his friend, lied about it to police originally, ended up with probation. I think he was grounded for a month, basically put on house arrest. So here we've got this headline from a KSTP: South St. Paul man given 3 years probation for threatening others with a rifle. Yeah, now in this case, nobody was shot, thankfully, but 62-year-old John Anthony Gogala was convicted of one count of second-degree assault. He was sentenced to 36 months in prison, and he had the entirety of that sentence stayed in lieu of 3 years probation. This, after he threatened a man with a rifle, ended up involved in a standoff with SWAT team members for several hours. According to authorities, Gogala ended up accosting a man as the man was trying to move a family member out of an apartment complex. Gogala said that... He said, I quote, "I'm going to go look for a gun," after he yelled and insulted the man. Man said that he then saw Gogala holding a rifle and yelling while pointing it at the door of the apartment. And when police arrived, officers said they told Gogala to put his weapon down, but he reportedly replied, "I'm good. I'm going back in my room," before going back into his apartment, which led to the 6-hour standoff. Gogala was eventually taken into custody peacefully. Again, glad nobody was hurt in this incident. I'm not even sure that, you know, 36 months behind bars is appropriate, but 36 months of probation, yeah, that doesn't seem that appropriate to me either. How about, 12 months behind bars, 2 years probation, 2 years behind bars, 12 months probation, something like that. But seems to me like, you know, a little bit of time behind bars would be good. I guess Gogala was sentenced to 45 days of jail time, but he was given credit for the 45 days that he spent in jail awaiting trial. So, yeah, that's all done, and I guess that's all the time that he will serve for that offense. On to today's Armed Citizen story. From Illinois, where an intruder is facing charges after being shot during a home invasion in Arcola, Illinois. Don't have a lot of details. This happened, I believe, back in January. A guy named Dalton Cresson, now charged with attempted home invasion, residential burglary, and criminal trespassing, all felony offenses. State's attorney, Rob Kosick, says that back on January 17th, Cresson tried to break into a home in Arcola. Person living at the house was present, was armed with a gun, and shot Cresson as he tried to break in. Oddly, the local media outlet WCIA says that as the Illinois State Police took over the investigation from the Arcola Police Department, the community was unaware that the shooting was in defense of property. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. First of all, I think if this was solely in defense of property, the homeowner might be facing charges, and that's not the case here. But also, if the homeowner shot the intruder as the intruder was entering the home, why would this – I don't understand why the local media outlet would say this was a defense of property. You don't know what the intentions of that individual might be as they're trying to crawl through your window, right? You just know that they're not supposed to be there. Are they after your stuff? Are they willing to harm you while they're trying to get your stuff? Or are they there solely to try to harm you? It just seemed like a weird little addition in that local media story, especially given the fact that the homeowner who shot Kosick is not facing any charges, or Cresson rather, but Cresson himself. Again, facing multiple felonies. We'll see if we can get any more details on that story in the days ahead. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Out of Indiana, a neighbor saving an 80-year-old man who fell into the ice while ice fishing. You know, if you don't go ice fishing, you can't fall into the ice there. Just a handy tip for you. Trafalgar, Indiana, Trafalgar Fire Department says it was this past weekend, I think it was Sunday afternoon, just before 4 p.m., called out to the scene where a man had fallen into the water. But by the time they got there, the man had already been saved. So it turns out a neighbor saw the 80-year-old man fall into the ice. The Trafalgar Fire Department says that the neighbor jumped into action, grabbed a rope from a nearby barn, tossed it to the man, and, quote, more than likely saved his life. He was taken back inside to warm up. Firefighters were able to check him out at the scene. And looks like he is going to be okay. Again, thanks to the quick thinking and the fast actions of that unidentified neighbor. So there you go. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Anonymous Good Samaritan, we thank you for your very good deed. That is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Alan Gottlieb from the Second Amendment Foundation. He's over in Germany, actually, right now. We're going to be talking about some domestic issues, including the fact that Kash Patel, now the acting director of the ATF, what might that mean for the future of the agency? We'll talk about that and more with Alan Gottlieb. Looking forward to doing that. And be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, including a stupid, dumb infringement on our right to keep and bear arms that is on the move in Colorado regarding ammo sales to young adults. We've got that and more for you at the website. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your 2A Tuesday. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and be free.